Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gib.
I'm going to start with a couple emails here. One of them with a greetings, it says with an exclamation point. That always gets my attention. Mm-hmm. Thanking us for highlighting the recent studies on the glymphatic system. This is in reference to a study we talked about last week with Aaron Yamamoto out of Oregon, where they took a look at the human brain and established for the very first time, at least in human brains,
mapped the path by which waste is, I don't know, how the brain rids itself of waste.
Yeah, of cellular waste. So when you hear about things like tau and amyloid betas or beta amyloid, these things connected to possibly to neurodegenerative diseases, and in a healthy brain, those would probably get flushed out. For example, when you're sleeping, and it's possible, we're entering the realm of speculation, that in an unhealthy brain, suffering from a neurodegenerative disease, that they're not getting flushed out. And what those researchers found was kind of the network of the fluid network, you could kind of describe it as, the perivascular system, part of the glymphatic system, that allows the cerebrospinal fluid to go in and out and kind of cleanse us. Anyway, so back to the email. The Frederick is the person who wrote us. He said, as a practicing physiotherapist / craniosacral therapist, I believe that therapeutic methods exist that are being substantiated by this latest research and have proven benefits. He linked us to a study that I took a look at. And to summarize it just in brief here, it is hypothesizing in that study that the state of your CSF or your cerebrospinal fluid is connected to your health. And it's a new way of thinking about it. The idea that this fluid is going from your spine up to your brain and back in and out, that the health of that, the ability of those fluids to move, is very strongly connected to your health. That's the hypothesis. This seems obvious when you think about it that way, because it's kind of like your vascular system, blood moving.
Yeah, well, blockages anywhere aren't good, right?
Right. And this is a way to think about your brain and the fluid that moves in and out of it. And its ultimate health system. So thank you, Frederick, for the email and for the link to that study. And again, thanks to Erin Yamamoto and her team for talking to us.
Another thing we talked about last week was the use of AI in podcasts, right?
Oh, well, yeah.
You played a tool by Google that allows you to take a pretty dense text, throw it at this LLM.
Yeah, Notebook LM.
Notebook LM, sorry. And It summarizes that text not only in bullet point form, it creates a podcast with two voices that sound really real and really pretty good.
Yeah, two American accented quote unquote people, a man and a woman, and they discuss the information in a way that sounds like disturbingly like a real podcast.
82 using, get this, undersea cables.
Undersea cables. Hold on, like the ones we use for the internet. Are you serious?
I am serious. It's brilliant. Salt water moving through the Earth's magnetic field actually creates tiny electrical currents.
Ah, okay.
And these cables, they pick up on those voltage changes.
No way. So they turn the seafloor into like a giant voltmeter.
You got it.
We got an email from Annie talking about AI in the news. She says, recently our local newspaper, I still get the paper daily, asked its subscribers about how comfortable they are with AI being part of the news reporting. Overwhelming majority of respondents said it was okay to use AI to be part of the news writing, but it must, in all caps, be reviewed for accuracy, etc., by a human being. Love your show. I catch most of them on Sunday mornings at 4:30 a.m.
You people amaze me. Thank you for being awake and listening to us at that bright and early, and at this time of the year, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, very dark hour. Yeah. Can be kind of cold. But hopefully we warm you and your soul and your brains.
Yeah, yeah. Her conclusion is AI can be good or great, but we still need human oversight. And we asked a question last week when you created that podcast for people and let them listen to it. Would you guys rather have that or us? And not many responses came in. Come on, I was wondering. I thought you guys would overwhelmingly and resoundingly say we want you guys.
Maybe,
but you didn't.
Maybe yeah. AI
and I'm
is
losing
the
sleep over it. Thanks a lot.
No, yeah, there should always be people in between. The point of playing that for you, we don't want to play you fake stuff or artificially intelligent generated sound. It's that this is what it sounds like. It's coming. The volume of it is going to be enormous. It's going to overwhelm podcast platforms. And what are the strengths of that technology and what are the limitations? I see a lot of limitations and some strengths as well. Anything else we should talk about on the show? Any other science, any other studies that you've come across? Send them our way. We can't reply to all of them.
Yep.
But they help make this show what it is, su@dw.com.
All right, and the rest of the show this week, at least, is going to be about making babies.
Or not.
We're going to get to embryos in a second, but first we're gonna stop them in their tracks.
Well, in a way,
talk about contraception.
Yeah, it's about stopping or pausing two aspects of the human pregnancy. And to explain more, we are joined by our colleague, Aline Spantig, in studio with us. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, Aline.
Hello.
Aline, you're here to talk about male contraceptives. And real quick, I think it's worth saying that at this point, part of the reason we wanted you to come in today is because you have something new, something novel to talk about, which is always really exciting because Gabe and I have grown up in a world where we had functionally two options.
Condoms and vasectomy.
Right. I've done both, and I know what they are, and yet...
Now that you've done the second one, you don't need to do the first one anymore.
Right. That's the point of the second one.
I'm still using the first one, I guess.
Yeah. Those are our options as guys, and so it is genuinely exciting to hear not just about like future possibilities, but about something that is available right now, and Aline, I believe you have it in your pocket. And Gabe, you've never seen this before.
No.
I do have, but maybe first I have to...
It's a thing? What?
I have to make a little disclaimer because I don't want anything illegal to go on here. I must say officially, it's not, it doesn't have medical certification. So I don't know if it's illegal to refer to it as a contraceptive device as it's still like...
Well, okay, well then take the device...
No. That's very important that you say that, Aline. And then my next question would be, where are you hearing about this device? Is this a trend on social media platforms? Where what are we talking about here, and where did you hear about it?
I was in Paris in this event on contraceptive rights, and I met this guy who invented this thing, and I was so surprised when he told me, guys, you don't have to wait. There are plenty of options already out there. You can practice thermal male contraception.
Can I see this thing, Aline?
I can show it to you. Let me get it out. Okay. Here you go.
Okay. Gabe is about to hold it in his hands for the first time.
I'm holding this in my... This hasn't been used before.
Describe, Gabe.
Okay, so I used to play baseball, and you used to put on a baseball bat something to make it a little heavier. It was a ring. You put it on the bat.
A donut.
A donut. This looks like a small donut.
What I was going to compare it to, it looks to me like...
A large wristband?
Yeah, exactly. For anyone, this is a very North American reference, but for a period of time, these Lance Armstrong bracelets, they were yellow and made of rubber or silicone. Everyone seemed to be wearing them for a certain period of time, and this is like like three times as thick as that.
Used to have one that said WWJD.
Oh, yeah. You know, those were a big thing, too. Everyone did at that period in time. Okay, a thick blue, is this a silicone ring, looks like?
It definitely would make a beautiful bracelet as well, and that's actually what he sells it at the moment. He sells it as like a decorative object.
But it's also apparently some kind of contraceptive device. How in the world would this...
You don't wear it around your wrist.
Right. Otherwise, it would, that would have zero effect. Where do you place this thing? I have a guess.
Yeah? What is your guess?
Around the stuff downstairs.
Exactly. So the whole point is that you increase the temperature of your testicles by 1 to 2 degrees. And that ring, you slide your penis through, then you slide your scrotum through, and by that, you bring your testicles closer to the body. Because nature was very smart. For sperm production to be ideal, the testicles, they need a little bit of lower temperature. So that's why they hang a little bit down there. And this ring helps you to get them closer to the body. So just by the natural warmth of the body, they're getting 1 to 2 degrees warmer.
And how long would I have to wear this thing in order for it to work, to raise the temperature enough so that I'm not...
Fertile. So that your sperm are rendered... Immobile.
Motility, right?
Yeah.
The instructions, they say for 15 hours a day. And for when you
15
hours a day.
A day.
So all, like you like, would have your a watch around your wrist for the whole day, and when you go to sleep in the night, you take it off. Yeah. It's the same way.
I was going to say,
for me, it's pretty annoying to wear a watch. I'm assuming that 15, that can't be a very comfortable thing to wear for 15 hours a day.
I think this is something everybody has to find out for themselves, right? But like, if I think about it, when I'm on my menstruation, I use this like menstrual cup. It's also made out of silicone. I wear it for 24 hours a day. Or if you use a tampon, same thing. Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, it's a comfort thing, something you have to get used to. I talked to a lot of guys at this event. They said, yeah, they just got used to it. They could sit normal. They could walk normal. There was one guy, he had a bit of a problem when he was exercising. But yeah, I guess you have to figure that out for yourself. And
I was going to say, first of all, yeah, we have to be skeptical here because you picked this up from someone who's trying to sell something, right?
And this is also a science show. We should probably talk about
I'm
the science.
I'm not really sure if like he's like a big commercial guy, because on his website you can really also download like a DIY instruction and make like a mold yourself. And the impression I really got from him is he doesn't want to make money with it.
He wants to help men prevent accidental pregnancies, right? This is the purpose. And in that sense, that's why this is a little... We have to be careful how we talk about it, because this is, men are screaming for this, right? Like, all we've had access to are condoms.
They are like, on this planet, they're like 2 billion men in reproductive age, and there are like very few options for them. Like you said yourself, like just condoms or vasectomy, that's it.
We would pay really good money between the ages of like, let's say 14 and 45 to know with 100% certainty, I'm not going to accidentally create new human life. So I guess my question is there any evidence or any data that tells us if you use this ring, put it on for 15 hours, and the testes get warmer, how much would that will that reduce the sperm count?
Well, there are studies showing that since decades, that in itself is not new. They tested it on couples that used thermal contraception as their only way of contraception. I have like 3 studies in my mind now, and in total it was more than 500 menstrual cycles where these couples, they only used this ring, and there no
five,
pregnancy occurred.
500 menstrual
cycles in total.
Yeah. I guess very important for any of our listeners, especially the young, impressionable male listeners out there, I can only assume that if you're even considering something like this, that it would be in combination with, at this point, the only other real male contraceptive, with condoms, right? You're not putting this on for 15 hours a day and then having unprotected sex. I mean, ignoring the sexually transmitted infections right now, you can't do that, because the chances of pregnancy have to still be there. This is not getting you down to zero.
Yeah, the whole thing is the whole male contraceptive market has to develop. But there's this demand there. There are so many guys out there, it's also studies showing it, that there's this need. But then it's the question, like, why are new methods not getting developed? And I talked to some expert in the industry, and he told me that there's this joke in the industry that they always say, like, okay, male contraception, it's always 10 years away, since 50 years.
Nuclear fusion.
In researching this story, we reported a year ago on one of the potential medications in the pipeline. What was that, Gabe? It was
soluble adenylyl cyclase. It's in almost every cell in the human body. If it's inactivated, if it's inhibited, sperm motility is zero. That's a study that's been done on mice. There are no studies being done or trials being done on humans, but if that were the case, it would be something that would render people like you. I mean, you would never, ever be. You'd be sterile.
We can even move away from mice. Like, there's even other things in the pipeline that are already being tested in humans.
Hormone-based, or?
There's one hormone-based thing. It's a shoulder gel. It came as far in the medical trials as no other product before. They are now testing it on humans. It's something you can apply on your shoulder with hormones. Mm-hmm. There is a non-hormonal gel that you can inject in the pipe that carries sperm and blocks it there. It's also being tested in human rights now. And there is a non-hormonal daily pill. It's also tested in humans right now. But it's difficult to get through this whole process of medical certification. It's very expensive, and big companies are not willing to invest. I reached out to the major players, and they either don't comment or they are saying openly that they don't see a potential for success in the market. That was what Bayer was telling me, for example. Because like 10 years ago, they tested a male contraceptive method, and they told me in a statement, okay, it was shown to be effective and with tolerable side effects, and that then they didn't see that it could be a commercial success, and they stopped all research into male fertility.
Mm. But for now, I think based on what we've discussed, it's safe to say that in addition to using all the other contraceptives available to men out there, it's possible that a device like this one, a ring, might in the future decrease the likelihood of having an accidental pregnancy while still acknowledging that we have to look at what the side effects would be. I'm just looking at this thing like that, Mike. It doesn't cut off circulation after 50 hours?
I don't like looking at it.
Man,
I want
you gotta
it
try. I want it you off, gotta try.
I want to get it off my desk.
Yeah, guys, you gotta try. Really.
I'm fortunately past the point of having to, but it's an interesting idea. And in general, to kind of go back to the beginning, I like the idea of new things being tested because, frankly, yeah, men don't have too many options.
It's a way to get to know your body also. Like the guys I was talking to at the event, for them, it's like self-empowerment, like being able to control your fertility. For once, you can take responsibility. But second, it also teaches you about your body. And finally, you can step up and take responsibility for what your body is capable of doing.
If it works. And that's the question. The data that we have from the past suggests it probably should. We don't know. We're not endorsing it. It's just one more thing. I was going to say in the pipeline, but this is actually a physical object that exists and is still sitting on the table in front of us.
It's already there. And now it's in the trials getting tested to get medical certification. And the inventor, he thinks that by 2030, they will be through the clinical trials and then it will have like a medical certification stamp on it.
2030. Thanks for stopping by, Aline.
Thank you, Aline, for joining us in studio. And feel free to pick this thing up and Take it away from Gabe.
Get it away.
For all of the people out there who have had children, here's just a bizarre question to even think about. If you could have, would you have hit pause on the embryo's development? So the fertilization of the egg has happened. It's going to develop into a fetus and ultimately into a baby. But imagine you could pause it and be like, no, not yet. Let's wait a little bit.
Why would I do that?
I don't know. Maybe the timing's off or something.
We can do that.
That's the crazy.
Animals do it.
Yeah, animals do it, but humans apparently can or could. That's the crazy implication of some Max Planck Institute research. It ultimately has some potential applications for in vitro fertilization. We don't want to get anyone's hopes up or to give false hopes that that will happen soon, but it's worth finding out how to do this in human beings and why it might ultimately matter.
But first of all, in a Petri dish.
In a Petri dish. And for the rest of this interview, we're going to use the word embryo as if we're talking about actual human embryos. Just a big caveat here. These are not real human embryos. These are generated from stem cells, from pluripotent cells, and for all intents and purposes, act like a human embryo.
Science Unscripted.
So my name is Aydan Bulut Karslıoğlu. I'm a researcher at the Max Planck Institute for Molecular Genetics in Berlin, Germany. And together with my team and our collaborators, we recently found out that human embryos have this inherent capacity to self-regulate their developmental timing.
Aydan, you just said modulate with regard to an embryo's development. The way I understood it was that you could hit pause on embryonic development. Did I understand that right?
Exactly. And we can do that by altering the activity of a protein called mTOR, which regulates cellular growth. And by reducing its activity, we showed that we can slow down the development of human embryo models.
Let's get to humans in a little bit. First, let's stick with animals. We know that 100 or so animals do this naturally.
What's one of the animals?
Yeah. Let's go with one example and take us through what happens.
Exactly. I will give you two, if you allow me. One is, for example, roe deer, which is very common in forests of Europe.
Roe deer?
Like a white-tailed deer?
Roe deer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a deer. Yeah.
Exactly. And these animals mate in, actually, I should get this fact right. I think in the fall. And after mating, the sperm get fertilized to initiate the developmental programs of the species. But normally, if it goes on like this, the pups or the fawns are going to be born over the winter, which is less than ideal for further prosperity of this species. So what happens is that once the embryo passes through these initial few days of development and reaches the stage called blastocyst, then development is slowed down. So the embryo hits the pause button and takes a break from development, and it's reactivated actually 4 months later in this embryo to continue and to eventually give rise to the live progeny in the spring, which offers better conditions.
Okay, so the fertilized embryo is inside the womb of the female deer, the doe.
Exactly.
And senses chemically somehow, there's a chemical signal in there. Oops, it's too cold out there. I should slow down.
Well, sort of. This signal is reaching the embryo via the maternal system, because this is all hormonally regulated from the maternal side. And the maternal side tells its own system, essentially the uterus, that the development should not proceed at this stage. So the uterus now does not become receptive, the embryo cannot implant, and just resides in utero, in the uterine fluid, without implanting for a few months until it can do so at a later time point.
You wanted to mention a second animal? What was that?
Exactly. I wanted to mention a second animal, which could be the mouse in this case, because this is completely differently regulated. In the roe deer, I mentioned that this is seasonal, and it always actually works the same way every mating season for these animals. In the mouse, it's more acute, meaning depends on whether there's scarcity in the environment. So it's on-demand pause button, if you will. And what that means for the case of the mouse is that, of course, food is not a given thing. And if the mom is starving but is pregnant at the same time, then that risks the progeny. And at that point, then that mom can tell chemically by signaling to the embryos that this is not an ideal time to develop, and the development of that litter, again, can hit a pause button for a few days to a few weeks until nutritional sources are better.
And in both these animals, this process happens naturally. In human beings, it does not happen naturally, but you have somehow managed to make it happen? Fill us in?
Exactly. I have to say that it's very important to say we did not actually directly make this happen on human embryos. We used models of human embryos, which very closely represent the human embryos, but these are not embryos. I think this is very important to say at this point. Yes, otherwise you're correct to say that we could make this happen on human embryo models and stem cells. And the reason is very simple, actually. We know that a lot of mammalian species possess this capacity. And we have worked for years now in our lab with a system where we are able to put mouse embryos into pods like this in the incubator in the lab. And so we said a lot of regulatory events are actually conserved across mammals, meaning like they are applicable to a lot of different species. So the idea was very simple, and we essentially asked whether the same protein, the mTOR protein, can also regulate the timing of human embryo models, just like it does in the mouse.
And when you say that you're modifying the mTOR protein, is that in the uterus or is that in the embryo? What are you changing to make this happen?
So this is now entirely outside the maternal system, because anyway, in the human, we cannot do that. We don't want to do that. But also on mouse embryos, we collect the normally developing embryos from the uterus. We put them in cell culture in the incubator in the lab, and culture them with a so-called mTOR inhibitor to reduce the activity of this protein, and that puts them into a paused state. And now with these blastoids, which are human embryo models, we did the same. We took these and cultured them in cell culture in the incubator together with this mTOR inhibitor and showed that we can actually alter their developmental timing.
The reason why animals do this is to, you said, self-preservation or to make sure that the progeny survives. What would be the application of pressing a pause button on embryo development for human beings?
So here we should focus on technological applications, so not in vivo or not within the uterus, of course, but IVF has offered huge chances of success in human reproduction. It has helped a lot of families, and it's a very successful operation, has been recently developed within the last decades, actually. But there are also cases, even within this success story, where we don't understand why reproduction fails. And we guess that some of it comes from a mismatch of the timing of embryo's development and the maternal system. So here is where we hope we can make a difference in terms of gaining the extra time to perhaps time things better from both sides, or perhaps even to characterize the embryos better. Because once you start embryonic development, starting with an egg and a sperm, you only have a very limited time frame to complete these first stages and to transfer the embryos, if they're not going to be frozen, into the mom. Now we hope, of course, with some further work and development, that we can gain more time within that time frame.
So I'm going to wildly speculate here based on what you just said. 10 years from now, 15 years from now, a couple walks into a clinic, they want to get pregnant, they're having issues, they're struggling, it's not happening. And to possibly increase their chances of getting pregnant together, they might take an mTOR protein therapy that would adjust the amount of time where that embryo would be viable to attach. That might be like a step before IVF. Is that completely off?
Time-wise, it's hard to speculate when that could happen. And this, again, was the very first step of even showing that that is possible. So I think we also have to be careful about developing it enough before offering therapies. But yes, essentially, if it gets to that stage, the offered therapy could be potentially to alter the timing of the embryo in the clinic before it is transferred to the mom, so that one just has more time for characterization and for better matching of the embryonic and maternal systems.
And that was Aydan Bulut-Karslioglu talking to us from Berlin, in that case. And if you're interested in reading up on the public or looking at the publication, this is mTOR Activity Paces Human Blastocyst Stage Developmental Progression in the journal Cell.
And she wanted us to reiterate at the end that we're not working with human embryos. It was in a petri dish. These were what's called blastoids. Not at all actual human embryos. And she also wanted us to mention, do not get your hopes up at this point. If you're hoping from hearing this that it's going to help you with IVF, the research is not at that point yet, but it could be one day, essentially.
Yeah. This is, I think, from her perspective, basic research. It's interesting. It's important. It leads to lots of interesting speculation, but it's just that at this point. Anything else to say? Tell us. Say it to us. We're su@dow.com.
DW, made for minds.